Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Wednesday. It's April 21st, 27 degrees here and clouds in Old Town Park City. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's Caesar. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you. Yes, and cloud cover is definitely what we are expecting to see throughout the rest of the morning and even into tonight. Some possible snow showers are always there, as we can expect to see that it does turn over to a little bit of some rain and snow mix throughout the afternoon hours as we begin to warm up. We'll see a high of 44 degrees, and it slowly starts to taper away as we expect to see that low pressure system finally moving east, no longer really obscuring our view of the sun for the next day. We'll see a high of 48 for Thursday, and ooh, it's going to be sunny. It's going to be great. We do miss that sun at times. And for Thursday, we expect to see that it slowly starts to become a little bit more on the cloudy side for the overnight hours. We'll see a low of 30. But by Friday, we expect to see, again, another mostly sunny day, temperatures ranging around 50 degrees. We do expect to see a slight breeze coming in from the south-southwest, becoming northwest during the day. Friday night, we start to clear out once again. 31 degrees will be our low. Breeze does die down. We then see a warm-up for Saturday, but an increase in cloud cover also as the next weather maker is starting to make its presence felt. We can expect to see a high of 57 degrees, and then by Saturday, we start to see the first telltale signs of some shower activity because of that low-pressure system. It does make its way in slowly into the Beehive State Forest, a low of 38 on Saturday. And for Sunday, we will expect to see some warmer temperatures once again, 56 degrees, slowly but surely seeing a little bit more cloud cover and even some possible spotty showers here and there throughout the day. We'll see a high of 56. Sunday night, we expect to see a low of 36, but again, it will be on the mostly cloudy side, becoming a bit more rain and then even some possible snow mixing in. By Monday, we then start to see the bulk of the precipitation really making its way in. Rain and snow showers are going to be likely for us with a high of 44 before then cooling down and seeing a low of 30 through Monday night. And then by Tuesday, we still see a slight chance of showers as that low pressure system continues to move to the east with partly sunny skies at 45 degrees. From the Pinpoint Weather Center, I'm meteorologist Cesar Cornejo.
Thanks, Cesar. KPCW News Time now, 8:08. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Heber City Council member Ryan Stack with an update from last night's city council meeting. Later on, Tom Cowley with with details on the lecture that he's given tonight for the Park City Museum on the history of skiing in Park City. Finally, the executive director of the Park City Historic Alliance, Allison Kulo, will have an update from yesterday's board meeting. Stay tuned.
Jazz pianist Herbie Hancock explores genres from soul and funk to folk and rock in a career of breaking down musical barriers. Then mandolin virtuoso Rhonda Vincent tells of travels in the Family Bluegrass Band. Plus music from Joni Mitchell, Billie Holiday, Hugh Masekela, and Waylon Jennings on American Roots from PRX. American Roots here on Sundays on KPCW.
Also, stay tuned. Coming up on The Mountain Life right after the local news hour this morning, today's guests include Amber Raleigh, the co-founder and CEO of the Grow Community Center Cafe and Food Truck, now open for business in Park City. Then neuropsychologist Simon McCarthy Jones has written a new book about the basic human instinct, spite. He draws on research in biology, game theory, economics, and psychology to argue that spite comes from our primal impulse for fairness and justice. All of that coming up on today's edition of The Mountain Life. Again, 9:06 right after the local news hour and NPR News. Well, the Park City Board of Education yesterday heard from parents not wearing masks during the meeting, asking the board to override the state mask mandate in our schools. Parents of baseball players also asked the board to install artificial turf on the high school ball field. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has more.
To allow public comment during work meetings. Board President Aaron Grady explained before public input started, they will not allow political or disrespectful comments.
I have an Elizabeth Smith, but I have to talk to you, Elizabeth. I don't see where what your is not part of our agenda items. Any public comment has to be a part of the agenda item.
I do have some items part of the...
Can you tell me what that agenda, what you're speaking on behalf of the agenda?
Mr. Hover, equity and equal success, and I'd like to bring that up, and also social emotional support that might be lacking. So I'd like to bring those items up.
No, I understand that, but I'm not...
Parent Elizabeth Smith said the state order allows mask exemptions at the direction of a parent. She also asked for additional staffing in the counseling and mental wellness area to help children navigate the social and emotional impacts of the past year.
I feel like not honoring those exemptions might be construed as discrimination against our children for medical, psychological, and developmental reason. So I'm asking to immediately accept mask exemptions. I have a 9-year-old boy who was very happy and energetic and carefree about a year ago, and now he's anxious and depressed.
Superintendent Jill Gilday, in response, said school districts do not have the authority to change the school mask mandate.
I have just come from a couple of days of meetings around the state, and the public health order that outlines the mask mandate is in effect through June 15th, as outlined by the governor, as well as several different legislative bills that were passed.
A verbal disagreement ensued, and Grady and Gilday said the conversation was out of order. Grady ended the public input session.
The parents.
Okay, I'm going to stop this right now. This is not a back and forth. This is not a question. So you just came up and read your statement.
That wasn't my statement. I was an answer to her rebuttal on her comment.
Turning to other issues, two parents asked the board to install artificial turf on the high school baseball field. They cited multiple concerns that included vole damage in the outfield, field conditions, and no place to practice during the high school season. Grady said on behalf of the board, they hear the baseball parents' concerns. She said they are also highly focused on master planning implementation, but will consider the issue carefully.
We have received over 50 letters from the parents of the baseball team. We hear you. We want you to know that we are listening to you. We've heard you. And it's something we're considering.
Park City School District Chief Operations Officer Mike Tanner told the board turf replacement on the ball field would cost $4 million. He said they're considering installing bleachers, estimated at $100,000. One parent, Steve, said they don't want bleachers. He thinks replacing turf on the infield and providing 10 more batting cages would help the team more. You can find the link to the entire audio of the public comments on kpcw.org. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
Well, the Heber City Council met last night. On the phone with me now, I have Councilmember Ryan Stack. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So the meeting started with an update on a compensation study undertaken by City Manager Matt Brower. What did you guys find out?
So last year, it was one of the council's priorities to do a wage analysis for Heber City. And we got a whole bunch of data points back. And so far, what it looks like is the city has some ground to make up in trying to be more competitive with its wages, both for competing for new employees when it comes to hiring, as well as retaining employees. And a lot of the challenges are to do with the cost of living in the area. And so what we decided is to bring it back to the council on May 1st, and we want to have a more narrowed region as in terms of comparables for the council to analyze. We want to look at what public entities are doing as far as pay on the Wasatch back, and then we also want to look at what they're doing for pay in the areas where we're most competing. We found many of the applicants for our recent positions are actually coming from the Wasatch Front. From Salt Lake Valley, from Utah Valley. And so it's presenting some unique challenges for Heber City to make itself more competitive to attract and retain employees.
Yeah. One graph showed that for some of the less technical jobs, the Heber City staff is making as much or more as those that were surveyed. But I guess it was for those making $65,000 and above, they aren't being paid nearly as well. I think it was the number 17% less. It seems like that this job value number that you're using has a lot to do with not only how difficult the job is, but perhaps how difficult it would be to replace the position?
A lot of it has to do with retention, right? And one of the things we have to factor in is even if our pay scale is on parity with the city along the Wasatch Front, an applicant may oftentimes look to the commute as a tiebreaker in deciding to stay local with where they want to go. And that's something we've seen. So we're starting the process of analyzing how do we account for that in our compensation, and how can we make ourselves more competitive? Because what we're seeing is a lot of the people who already are, who work here and live here are inclined to want to stay. The challenges for the people who are commuting in every day from parts further away, and how can we be competitive to retain them, and how can we set ourselves up to make sure that we continue to attract and retain our best workforce possible.
Okay, so you mentioned that's coming back May 1st. Any sense whether the Heber Council has the willingness to pay more?
May 1st is also going to be in line with some of the budget discussions we start having. And so we want to have this conversation against the broader backdrop of what our budget's looking like in the next fiscal year and what opportunities we have to try and position ourselves to do something with the pay scale and adjust where needed and where necessary. I think there's certainly an openness and a willingness to have those conversations. I think we also just need to make sure we're having that discussion in the context of our city budget as a whole, which is what we're going to be doing on May 1st.
All right. Let's see. The council also got an update on the proposed garden apartments located at 500 North and 160 West. Council being asked if it supports a zone change for the redevelopment of this project. It's currently a senior care facility?
It was the old Rocky Mountain Care Facility. They built a new structure on 1200 South in town, and that's been up and running for a couple of years now. And so this old facility has just been sitting vacant and rotting, in essence. Nothing's been happening with it. And so the proposal that we considered last night really is to enter into an MDA. The applicant has done the engineering and done the review. It looks like the structure could support a second story. And what they're proposing is would be 32 units of one and two bedroom apartments, three of which would actually be restricted and designated as affordable housing. But the rest would be for rent one and two bedroom units. The council voted to move forward in having the discussion with the developer. We have a willingness to explore the MDA for this project to go forward because we feel like it meets a very real need for affordable housing in Heber.
All right, so an MDA is like a master development agreement, is that?
Yes, sorry, okay. That's right.
Yeah, all right. Now, my understanding is that the applicant has been waiting about a year on this application because the downtown overlay zone changes aren't still finished, and what you heard is that could take another 6 months or a year to do. So did you decide that you will move forward with this applicant despite that?
Yeah, right. There's some other things kind of going on that have affected what's happening with the rewrite or the creation of the downtown overlay zone. And so while nothing was formalized or approved last night as far as this applicant's concerned, we did express a willingness to move forward in those conversations. And the issue of what's happening with the downtown zone you referenced is staff had been working on that or was going to start getting to it in earnest. And the process with the city's effort on some other things like the North Village Overlay Zone wound up being a lot more intensive and time-consuming than I think was originally anticipated. And so that put some other projects like the downtown zone on the back burner. And so I think staff is now hoping to be able to turn to the downtown zone, but it may still take a while. But we as a council feel that this proposal is in line with what we would be looking at doing overall with the downtown zone as far as revitalizing downtown and wanting to keep higher density around the downtown core.
All right. Council also had a 30-minute conversation scheduled with Wasatch County School Superintendent Paul Sweat. Anything interesting there?
Plenty interesting. A lot of it is putting numbers to a reality. I think a lot of us in this valley have already been sensing, and that is about growth in the schools. Superintendent Sweat was on for the presentation. A number of the school board members were also on to ask and answer some questions. And basically, the growth continues. Some of the numbers we looked at show that total K through 12 enrollment as of 2020 is just over 7,000. And in 10 years, total K through 12 enrollment will be just under 9,000. Our high school, if trends continue, could have about 600 more students in the next 5 years. And so there are some realities we're facing with what's happening with growth in the valley, with the pressures that's placing on our schools. And so Wasatch County, the school board approached us about having those conversations and just keeping an open and ongoing dialogue with the city and trying to come up with ways that the city can help them as they start visioning. And that includes things like in the potential annexation areas, looking to negotiate tracts of land that could be left open for school sites. And that is something that has been left open. I think in the Sorensen property, there's a civic site that could be used potentially for a future school. But looking at what's happening with the school system and the growth, and that also puts pressure on the city and other entities in the valley for affordable housing. Superintendent Sweat said that they are hiring 60 new teachers this year out of 450 teachers in the school system. He said about 30% of the teachers are coming from Salt Lake area or Utah Valley. And for those who have to commute, it's really high turnover just because of the stresses and demands of the commute. And it kind of loops back into the need for affordable housing in the area.
Yeah. So in terms of that growth, I mean, the council can't do anything about it, or can you? I mean, can you slow it down some?
Well, slow it down is always an interesting point, right? Because if we are faced with an application from somebody who owns a lot of record and it's zoned, they are entitled to build according to their zone as long as they meet the code. There is a mechanism under state law to impose a six-month moratorium on areas within the city, but there are certain requirements that have to be met, such as we're considering new codes or ordinances that would apply to those areas. And some of those conditions precedent for moratorium are not existent right now. And so it's just making sure that we're carefully considering, you know, what's coming before us. A lot of the growth is happening in the county out east of Mill Road, actually. And then I'm sure you're referencing some of the other areas that the city's looking to annex. And the challenge there is those areas, too, are already zoned for mixed-use high density in Wasatch County, even if the city were to do nothing.
All right. Let's see. State Road 13 Corridor Preservation Agreement. This is a cooperative agreement between UDOT, Heber, and Midway for access to the state road. Is the purpose here to try and limit the curb cuts, or what's it about?
I think UDOT just wants to make sure the cities are on board with preserving their access, because they are looking at future lighted intersections along 113 between Heber and Midway.
Okay. And then the Jordan L. Ridge Developers, also known as the Sorensen Annexation Property there, asking the council to create a PID, a Public Infrastructure District Policy. This is a distinct legal entity that's separate from the city, but it does require council approval?
That's right. It's a new creature under state law. It was authorized by Senate Bill 228. It became effective in May of 2019. These are local districts under state law, and you're right, they're independent political subdivisions. And they, if authorized by the city, they're allowed to issue debt that's not the city's debt. It's the debt of the entity itself, and then it's paid for by the residents who would ultimately live within that geographic area that's designated by the district. So it's a way for a developer to raise funds for infrastructure in an area where infrastructure might otherwise be quite costly. And what the city discussed last night is there are a couple of steps to the process. We have to first, if we want to move forward with this, come up with a citywide plan as applies to these public infrastructure districts. And then once we have a citywide plan in place, if that's the direction we want to go, then we would apply that plan to the individual applicants as they would approach the city. And so last night we voted 3-2 to move forward with discussing and researching the appropriateness of a citywide plan. We have some outside consultants who have been helping us in other areas. We've decided to loop them in to help us with this as well. And then once we have a plan in place, then we could consider the application from Sorensen or any other groups that wanted to come forward. But it's a way to allow the developer to raise money to pay for infrastructure and improvements. And obviously the city wants to make sure it's going to be a win for the residents in the area and for the city as well, and making sure that they use the money raised, if we go this way, to provide phenomenal infrastructure, connectivity, and enhancements for the city as well as the residents.
So those two council members who voted against this, I mean, what is it that they don't think this is the right way to build public infrastructure?
So I think there was a disagreement over the best way to move forward with the discussion. Initially, there was a motion to continue the item just to gather more information, and that motion failed 2-3. And that is what led to the motion to move forward, and that was a motion that ultimately carried 3-2. And I made that motion, and my motion that ultimately was approved was not to approve or authorize a plan, which we're still in the preliminary phases. And so we're looking at engaging the consultant to do the studies, get some sense of the numbers, and bring that information back to us so we can make a more informed decision. So I understand there, everybody on the council wants more information. I think there was just a difference of opinion about the best way to get it.
All right. And so if this does move forward, does it take the city planning department and building department inspectors out of the approval of or the work of this? I mean, does it allow this PID to kind of do their own approvals and inspections?
No, the PID itself wouldn't do that. It allows them as a separate entity to issue debt that would not be the liability of the city. The debt becomes a non-balance sheet item for the city, and it's repaid solely from a limited property tax assessment, a limited property tax increase that applies just to the area covered by the PID, or an assessment imposed by the PID. Construction and approvals still otherwise proceed according to city code.
Okay. Anything else from last night's meeting you'd like to mention?
There was an interesting discussion at the end about a possible wrap tax. At our retreat in January this year, the council had talked about exploring a citywide wrap tax, and it looks like Wasatch County is also exploring a wrap tax. And so we are going to be working with the county to find out what they want to do with their wrap tax, how and whether the city would benefit from it, and whether we would move forward with ours or ultimately let the counties proceed. So that's going to be an interesting item to keep an eye on.
So can there be two separate ones or not? It either has to be the city and the city only, or the county, which would affect all of the municipalities?
Because you have the county that could potentially propose one and the city that could potentially propose one, it is possible where each entity could propose its own wrap tax. But we just don't think that would be, very a good strategic move to just overwhelm the voters with multiple tax proposals on the same ballot.
Okay, all right, Ryan. Again, so this is just you'll be meeting with Wasatch County to kind of decide the best way to move forward with this, because you probably have a deadline coming up to get it on the ballot.
Yeah, coming up in May.
Yeah. Okay, Ryan Stack, member of the Heber City Council. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you so much, Leslie.
8:32 now. Good morning. 27 degrees and mostly cloudy skies. Again, looking for a chance of some showers today. Expected high up to about 44. Well, later today, the Park City Museum will be hosting an online lecture about the history of skiing in Park City. It's been given by one of our resident experts on the topic, Tom Kelly. He joins me now in the studio. Good morning.
Morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. So you, of course, have been following the ski industry for decades, so you could probably do this in your sleep. But tell us a little bit about...
Yeah, it's interesting. As you get older, history becomes a little bit more relevant for you because you've lived so much of it. But excited about today's presentation, and a big thanks to the Park City Museum for putting this on. There's a fascinating history of skiing here in town. And as I do this interview, I'm looking right out on the what's called the Creole Hill and the Creole Ski Jump right above Old Town that was used as a ski jump back in the 1920s and now is some of the runs going down to the town lift. But all of us ski here, and we spend our winters at Deer Valley and Park City and Canyons, Park West, Wolf Mountain, whatever you want to call it. But there's a history that goes way back before that, and we'll talk about that tonight, and we'll take it back all the way to the 19th century with miners who used barrel staves like skis to get around from the mines up on the mountain, and in the early 20th century when skiing started to become a thing, and skiers used to actually a good outing for a day was skiing from Park City up and over the mountain over Scott's Pass down to Brighton and staying at the Wasatch Mountain Club. So lots of cool things that have happened in our little resort town over the last 100+ years.
Okay. Now you started off as kind of a Nordic skier and kind of, I mean, that's where you things have built and then moved on, of course, to ski racing.
Yeah, my background, just to give my own history, I grew up in Wisconsin when I was 7 years old. That was 1960, by the way. Mom put the Olympics on TV, and I saw skiing for the first time, and I saw the Olympics, and it just kind of grabbed me as a kid. And probably the best mentor that I had on the historical side was I worked for this crazy entrepreneur in northern Wisconsin by the name of Tony Wise. And Tony was one of these pioneers back in the 40s who came out of World War II and wanted to get involved in recreation and in skiing. He'd seen skiing in Bavaria. And he taught me the importance of history. And I've always said, history is the roadmap to the future. You need to know where you came from and you need to know how things evolved, how they began in order for you to really look to the future. That was really instilled in me at an early age, and it's something that I've just carried with me. I've always been interested in the star athletes of the past, and I've also been very interested in how our sport evolved, not just here in Park City, but around the world. And the sport of skiing has a great history. It goes back to these caves and these old skiers from thousands of years ago in Scandinavia. So our skiing is much more recent here, but it all emanates from the mining history here in Park City.
Right. And again, I mean, that was, of course, part of the story there was a ghost town back in the early 60s, 50s, I guess, starting. And it was like, well, we may not have silver in these hills, but we certainly have got the snow gold on the hillside. So talk a little bit just about that early history there with Park City's decision to make it into the skiing.
The kind of modern era began, as you said, in the 60s. I'm going to touch back just a little bit, but there had been skiing in the area going all the way back into the 20s, the area of Ecker Hill, what is now Gorgoza, Woodward, the what's called Rasmussen Hill, Rasmussen Ranch, all of which is on the would be the south side of I-80 now as you come into town. There was even skiing going back into the 30s and 40s in what we know now as Deer Valley. Before then, it was known as Snow Park or Frog Valley. There was actually train service up to Park City. A train would drop you off right at what is Snow Park today. But the real modern era began in the 60s when the mines were starting to close and the mining companies were looking to say, hey, what can we do with our mountains? And this is a similar evolution that many Western mountains went through. The mines in Aspen and other places, eventually the mountains turned into ski areas. So in the 60s, the mining company decided it was going to invest in recreation. There was a great lobbying effort with the Kennedy administration to get federal funds, and in 1963, they built a gondola that, and think about this, folks, this was a 25-minute ride up the mountain, but that was one of the first gondolas in America and one of the most, at the time, modern means of conveyance, and you would get on the gondola down at the base place, and it would take you all the way up to the summit, but it would just take a long time to get there.
Yeah. So what was it, Snow Park then? Was that Park City's first ski area, or does it go back even further to the Gargosa ski area?
Well, it's hard to really pinpoint that, but if I were to say the first ski place, I won't call it an area, it wasn't really a business so much, but it was an area called Rasmussen Hill, Rasmussen Ranch. And to kind of identify where that is, it's a kind of behind Ecker Hill Middle School, a little bit to the east of Ecker Hill, which is in Pine Brook. And I think people know that area. But if you go to, down that ridgeline a little bit towards Kimball Junction, that was an area called Rasmussen Ranch. And people would come and they would ski uphill and then they would ski down. There weren't any lifts until somewhat later. But back in the 20s and 30s, people were skiing there. And then in the 30s, people were skiing over in the Snow Park area, which eventually became Deer Valley. And then in the 60s, the lifts went in at Park City. At that time, it was called Treasure Mountains. It wasn't changed to the Park City ski area for a few years, but it started at Treasure Mountains, and it was quite a thriving place. One aspect I'll talk about, and I think a lot of locals have probably heard about this, the skier subway. One of the crazy ideas they came up with is, well, why don't we move skiers through the mountain on a mine train and take them up a mine hoist up to the top? So that actually was done for about four seasons. You can actually see the entrance to that Spiro Tunnel now over at Silver Star, and they would go into the mountain 3 or 4 miles, and then they would go up about 1,700 or 1,800 feet and come out right at the base of what is now the Thames Lift. So that was an interesting conveyance, but it wasn't really practical and certainly not very safe. So they eventually went to more modern chairlift systems.
Yeah, have you found anybody who's actually ridden that?
I have not talked to anyone who has ridden it, but there still are a few around.
Yeah, yeah. And we should also notice that, you know, we talk about Snow Park now, Deer Valley, but Gargosa now Woodward, huh?
Yeah, that's an interesting history, too. The first formal ski area there was actually started by Cal McPhee, and Cal had run a ski area in Emigration Canyon right at the top there, and his lodge and facilities burned down, and he decided to move elsewhere. So in the, I think it was the late 40s, he moved over to the area that we now know as Woodward. So that's had a long history as a ski area. It's exciting to see what's there now with what Woodward is doing. Not a huge space, but a space that's providing a lot of fun for people on skis and snowboards.
Yeah. And then you also kind of alluded to just the history of what we knew as Park West, then Wolf Mountain, then the canyons, and now, of course, it is one Park City. But a good history there, too. I mean, just in terms of all of the legal maneuverings over the years.
You could write a book just about the legal maneuverings over the years there. It's fascinating, and one of the things that's intrigued me is how the run names have changed over the years. Park City West was started after Treasure Mountains, and it went through a variety of name changes and ownership changes, and it was a mishmash of landowners. One of the areas that's been fascinating to me, though, is looking at the evolution of what is now the Colony and is a part of the whole ski operation. There was actually a plan put together by Boyer Company back in 1981 to develop that, and they never quite came to an agreement with the landowners. And that got resurrected about 10 years later with Walt Brett and Company, and they ultimately did the partnership with American Skiing Company to develop that. So tonight I'm going to show a series of slides with old trail maps to show how that evolved in year one, year two, year three, and year four of that transition to now what we kind of take for granted. And then ultimately with the Quicksilver Gondola that was put in by Vail Resorts in Park City a few years ago, 2015 actually, it's made this just a ski paradise to have so much skiing along this one ridgeline.
Yeah. And not only the history, but you're also planning to take a look into the future tonight. And certainly, given some of the predictions due to climate change, skiing as we know it today may not even be a reality, huh?
Well, the ski industry still seems to be pretty bullish about the future. I mean, there's lots of signs that you can look at, but the ski industry still is pretty enthusiastic. So I'll talk a little bit about the Mayflower development that Extel is developing next to Deer Valley, talk a little bit about the private ski area that is being developed up by Morgan. So there's still an evolving future for us here, but I just look out every day at this ridgeline and say, we are so blessed to be in this town and have a great mining history, which is carrying on with amazing outdoor recreation in our mountains. So that's what we'll talk about tonight.
Okay. So it's all going to be done via a Zoom platform?
All being done via Zoom platform. You can go to parkcityhistory.org, the museum's website, and there's just go to events and you can click on the registration link. And you can also reach out to me personally if you can't find your way to navigate that. But 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock tonight should be a fun presentation. I know we have a large crowd attending, and welcome everybody to come by. It's springtime. You got a little bit more time in your hands, so let's learn about history.
Yeah. And is there an opportunity then to have some questions answered? Or
I do want to leave time for questions, and I'm always open for questions. You can just reach out to me on Facebook or Tom at TomKellyCommunications.com, and happy to answer your questions. And the other thing about history, and I'll talk about this at the start, history is ever evolving, and it's really, you never know exactly what happens. So if anybody has any information or tidbits they want to share, I'd love to hear them. And I want to piece this together and make sure that we leave this history for the next generation to look back to.
Okay. Tom Kelly, thanks.
Thanks, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:43. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. The Oakley City Council has passed a moratorium on culinary water usage for water features in town, including ponds and outdoor pools. KPCW's Rick Bruff has more on that.
The City Council passed the ordinance at their April 14th meeting. It says that Governor Spencer Cotts declared a state of emergency due to drought in mid-March. The Oakley Council stated that without conservation measures, water demand will soon exceed the city's water supply and capacity during the warm months when the supply is most limited. Oakley Mayor Wade Wolstenholme said that during his tenure leading the city, it seems like setting water limits has been an annual event.
And I will tell you what we found out is we have a development of homes that they have a lot of outdoor ponds and water features and stuff. Last year we was keeping track of water use, and we had like 10 houses using as much water as the rest of the city. What we're trying to do is we're working on getting better sources of water, but at the same time where most of the people in Oakley water with culinary, then that causes a problem.
The city has set a $10,000 fine for every violation of the moratorium. The ordinance halts the use of culinary water for all indoor or outdoor water features that don't have a culinary purpose. The ban includes ponds, lakes, outdoor pools, and waterfalls. The law sets out a few exceptions, such as hot tubs or spas not exceeding 600 gallons, and water features using water obtained outside of Oakley. Also, swimming pools that are entirely indoors are exempt, but they must be inspected and filled by May 15th. The mayor said residents are not prohibited from watering their lawns.
We haven't got any moratoriums on watering. We're just asking people to conserve and try to water twice a week and water at night. Just the usual stuff that Governor Cox and his memo for the state. But that's all we're doing at this point.
Wolstenholme said the city hopes to make some improvements in the near future to save on water.
We've done some modifications to our complex so we don't use as much culinary water to water it. We're looking into for grants to xeriscape a bunch of areas so we don't have to water it, but make it still look nice. And we're even going to be looking out for grants and things that we can do to eventually turf our ball fields, but we don't have to water that.
Oakley Mayor Wade Wolstenholme. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
8:47 now, good morning. Well, the board of directors of the Historic Park City Alliance met yesterday, and on the phone with a recap, I have Executive Director Allison Kulo. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning, Leslie.
So first, let's just get an update on your replacement. You're on the job till when? The end of May?
The end of June, so you get to chat with me two more times after this.
Okay. Sounds like you've had lots of applicants.
We have. So the executive committee, they went through, we put out a job description, took in applications, and we were able to conduct interviews, and a offer was placed to someone, and we're just waiting to finalize that before we can make an announcement.
Okay, so that should be shortly?
Yes, I believe we'll see that the beginning of May.
All right. And then will there be some time then for you to work with the new person? Or?
Absolutely. Our hope is that their start date would be June 1st, but during the month of May, hopefully they can attend some committee meetings and really start to get up to speed and understand the organization a bit better.
All right. I just wanted to mention that at last month's meeting, the board took a vote in opposition of supporting the proposed funding for the Arts and Culture District that was proposed by Park City officials. Any fallout from that?
I wouldn't say fallout. No. I think our decision to be able to take that stance and speak about it in the public, speak about it with the city council, I think has helped the project overall. I think it did highlight some areas where the potential funding that they were, you know, suggesting for the Arts and Culture District could, I guess, leave some projects unfinished or some needs in the future unfunded until, you know, that proposal that they had, you know, kind of ran out. But from our understanding, the city council is looking at kind of that, how they're going to use the Resort City sales tax, and at this point may not be using that for that proposal in the long run.
All right. The bulk of yesterday's meeting was spent working with a consultant, Word Search, to clarify the vision for Main Street. Is this just the start of the process?
Absolutely. So that whole discussion we had in March with regards to the Arts and Culture District, you know, during that discussion, you know, we kept saying, well, we wouldn't be able to fund any needs for Main Street. And Councilmember Gerber had mentioned, well, what are Main Street's needs? And it's been a long time since we've looked at what we needed to have done for the area. Our last time that we had taken a moment out to do some visioning and to really lay out a plan was in 2011. So that was 10 years ago. So we felt like this is a great opportunity to update our vision, especially since the council is asking, well, what are we trading when we spend money in one location versus another? So we felt like, let's kick this off. Let's start this process. We did have Word Search come in. They're a company that does similar processes of visioning through communities throughout the entire world. And we were able to see what they've done in the past and what they've been able to bring to fruition. And we're going to receive a proposal for them. But really, our May meeting will be discussing, do we want to move forward with visioning? How do we want this to, you know, what does that process look like? And we'd look at Word Search's offer. We may decide to look at other companies as well. But we feel like this is something that we want to launch. I see this probably being a six-month process. So we're right at the beginning.
Sure. And how much funding do you have for it?
Right now, we have no funding. So that's another piece. But of course, we're going through our budget right now. Our fiscal year starts on July 1st. So we're putting together our budget for fiscal year 22. And that's part of what we'll be looking at.
Yeah. And I guess it's just, there's so many differences of opinion already as part of the alliance. And I'm guessing, do you really think that you can all come to some agreement on what a future vision will look like?
Well, we've done it before, so I do believe that it can be done again, and I think it's all about how you do it, and that's going to be, I guess, where the rubber hits the road. We can go through a visioning process and only include those we want and have an idea of what we want for the future and kind of have that process take us there. But what I really see the board wanting to do is actually dig down and say, no, what do we want Main Street to look like? How can Main Street continue its evolution to continue to be relevant, continue to be the heart of town? And so to really go out and talk to everyone, if you're good at this job, as far as like doing visioning for other groups and communities and organizations, they'll be able to take us through this process. And not everyone will agree on everything, but the goal is that the overall picture for the future, we all are in sync with.
Yeah. So are there any givens then at this point about what Maine should be other than the heart of town?
You know, there are no givens. And there's not even a given, you know, with some of the items that we still have remaining from our 2011 plan. One of those being the brew pub. The 2011 plan outlined that as a community gathering spot where we would have events, where you could have concerts. And that process of design and development never made it through the final round. And that may not be what we feel is best for that lot now. And so to really look back and see where we want to go, I also know that there's been some pressure with regards to pedestrianizing Main Street. And I think this is a perfect way to explore that discussion and to put some fence posts in the ground as far as how everyone feels about that. You know, pedestrianizing Main Street is an idea, it's not a plan. And at this point, because I do see that coming up as a future discussion, I think it's something that needs to be addressed now and see, you know, where everyone is on that topic.
All right. Also, plans to restripe Park Avenue this summer. Does that create any problems for Main Street?
It does. So with the restriping of Park Avenue, they're going to be removing parking on one side of the street. And as many people understand, parking on Park Avenue is utilized by a lot of employees from Lower Main Street and Park Ave. So we're going to see some displacement of employee vehicles. We are working with the city on trying to identify, you know, parking for those employees. I think that's part of what started the employee parking permit program that we had this winter in China Bridge. But for us, you know, we're understanding that this is a trial program that, you know, they're going to paint this, see how it goes, and take comments throughout this. And we hope that just the impacts to Main Street is also considered along with the impacts to the residential neighborhood.
All right. And this is happening this month, my understanding, April.
Is it the 26th?
Okay. That's when messaging is happening. April 27th, no parking on both sides of the road. April 28th, the majority of the striping should be completed by the end of the day.
So, yeah, I mean, that's next week.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Any decision on whether we're holding the 4th of July is set to be made by the City Council, my understanding, on May 14th. Does the HPCA have a dog in this fight? I mean, is it something that you guys want to see? Or,
you know, that's something that we haven't discussed. Our events committee is going to look through just kind of an overview that the city is going to give us with their plans for 4th of July. We're going to run that through our events committee, get comments back to the city, and then hopefully be able to just do a quick board review via email prior to that city council meeting. You know, for us, there's so many variables that are impacting the 4th of July this year, one being on a Sunday when typically, you know, no pandemic, when 4th of July falls on a Sunday, a lot of the Valley doesn't celebrate 4th of July then that day. They do fireworks and parades on other days, which then causes Park City to see all that traffic come up. So I understand the need to mitigate that. We're also still in a health emergency, so what are we doing with regards to that? So I think we're going to be deferring to the county as far as health department regulations and the city for their permitting and see what they feel comfortable holding.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, I just, you know, encourage people to come up to Main Street. Parking has dropped as far as the cost goes, both for Main Street and for the side parking lots. So it has, we're in spring pricing right now, and China Bridge is always free until 5. So just definitely encourage people to come up and continue patronizing the local businesses.
All right. Allison Kulo, Executive Director of the Historic Park City Lions. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
The Park City Golf Course planning to open all 18 holes by next Friday. KPCW's Jessica Lowell has more on the start of the golf season.
Despite setbacks from construction and an unexpected snowstorm, the Park City Golf Course is tentatively scheduled to open for the season before the end of the month. Construction on the water treatment plant has affected the opening. Pond dredging near holes 12, 13, and 14 have been completed. Golf manager for Park City, Vaughn Robinson, says they plan to fill pond 14 this week, which will allow them to charge the irrigation system.
If we had water, we would have aerified before the snowstorm hit. The snowstorm obviously would have shut us down for probably 4 or 5 days. But, yeah, it's delaying us a little just because we don't have the water.
Dredging on Pond 18 will not be finished before the course reopens. But Robinson says golfers will still be able to use the green and fairway. Golf carts may be rerouted to sidewalks until the construction is completed. As people turn to the outdoors during the pandemic, Robinson says the course saw more than 40,000 18-hole rounds last year. This year, they're also expecting a large turnout.
My expectation would be that it would go down a little bit from last year. Last year was crazy busy for us. We had 8,000 more golfers last year than our biggest year ever since 2002, when we've kept track. So we had a lot more golfers last year.
Soldier Hollow's silver course is open, and their gold course will open later this month. Wasatch Golf's lake course is open. Their mountain course opens Friday. Canyon's golf course will open May 21st. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.
8:59, good morning again. We've got 28 degrees here in Old Town Park City. A chance of some snow before 1 o'clock this afternoon. Then maybe rain and snow mix later today. Expected high today of about 44. 26 is the overnight low. We've got a chilly morning tomorrow with sunshine in the forecast. 48 is the expected high, up to 50 on Friday. 57 and partly sunny is the forecast for Saturday. And a reminder that a vaccination clinic is open today for all Summit County employees. It'll be held from noon to 5 p.m. at the Treasure Mountain Inn. The Summit County Health Department will also be expanding clinics outside of the Park City area. Health departments in Camas and Colville are hosting vaccine clinics on May 1st. To schedule an appointment to get vaccinated, you can contact the Summit County COVID-19 hotline at 435-333-0050 or visit the website summitcountyhealth.org/vaccine. And also a reminder that the annual Lyrid meteor shower, marking the first big show of the year, it's peaking tomorrow, April 22nd. The Lyrid's best seen from the northern hemisphere, featuring about 10 meteors per hour. According to NASA, the Lyrids have been observed for some 2,700 years. Again, best time to see the show will be tomorrow morning after moonset and before sunrise. So that's that 4 to 5 a.m. time frame. The American Meteor Society suggests taking 30 minutes beforehand to let your eyes adjust to the dark without looking at your phone. And if your eye catches a meteor in the sky, you will be observing one of the lost pieces of Comet Thatcher. And no, I didn't make that up. It's 9 o'clock, time now for news. This is KPCW Park City.